does seem to be working that one. I'm actually saying in so many ways the past are pretty good. And first of all, gives us the opportunity here, 1st of April, financially speaking, to mark the fresh beginning in our calendar, because the budget will begin today officially, as it were, the allocation and utilization. Certainly, I hope that everyone has the opportunity to enjoy some time with their families, and of course, to renew their political roots again in the constituency. And I was with great sadness last night that I heard of the passing away the Deputy Minister of Health, Dr. Cipollaro. Many of us have worked with him for many years during New Year's days and here in Parliament, and I raised it in this committee formally because he served on this committee, trade and industry, for many, many years. And everyone who's worked with him can comment on how constructively he contributes to the committee for change in the economy and in South Africa for the people generally. So it was with great sadness we learned of that. And we certainly pass condolences of this committee to his family, his comrades and colleagues. He certainly will be sorely missed. Something else I read on the plane this morning was something in the Business Day, which some of you may have seen. You know, the last time we dealt with our annual report seemed so long ago. And it did seem to have been losing its shelf life, but I see it was given a fresh burst of life in the paper this morning. It's on the front page of the Business Day, where it refers in particular to the recapitalization of the IDC to kickstart the economy. But of course there are references to the other resolutions as well, in particular the gambling, our position here on that. But I really wanted to just indicate the point about the IDC, because we had said in the annual report we'd seen this as the driver in the turnaround, if you like, strategy, which is reflected in IPAP, job creation and so on, and the revitalization of the manufacturing sector, and the arrest of the decline in industry and the development, redevelopment of our industrial base. So you can certainly see that. It's a long article continued on page 2. The committee secretary has indicated there are some changes this morning. You will recall when we left, we had insisted that Tula come before the committee for us to engage on. And so far, not Kula, I mean Kumba Iron. Of course, we have had Kula so often, one can get confused. But they now deal, it's the economic development you're dealing with Kula. But the Iron Ore people will be coming on the 16th. They've tried, to insist that they would find it difficult to come, but we are insisting, and so they are going to have to come on the 16th. The other people who have not been able to be with us here this morning are ESKIM and the Biofuels Institute. So these are the three that we thought should be before us, and they have asked for the engagement to be rescheduled, and we are going to allow that. Meanwhile, though, the program which I asked to be handed off, I'm not sure if you have it already, we do have the South African Reserve Bank with us. We also have National Treasury with us. We'll then have a short tea break, followed by preliminary discussions on the committee's strategic plan before we conclude it tomorrow. After lunch, Zimbabwe Bilateral Investment Treaty, which has a deadline, and a briefing on Sarko-Makosa trade agreement. I've also asked for the minutes to be handed out to see whether or not we'll be able to address these tomorrow. And on that note, can we move forward? It's 10 o'clock now. Is everyone happy? Are there any apologies, sir? Ms. Helen Lyon, that is the only apology we've received so far, although we were made aware before we closed for Easter that there were two others who were catching later flights and who may only get here at about 11. But let us just see whether that does happen. So we're going to start off with Mr. Fareed, Dr. Fareed from the Reserve Bank. Thank you very much. And I think from here you'll see that we'd like to give you, as much time as you require, about 15, 20 minutes if necessary. Will that be sufficient? 20 minutes? Right, and we won't interrupt you at the moment. We'll save our questions for the end. So it's over to you. I think you're the chief economist at the South African Reserve Bank.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Deputy chief economist. Thank you very much, Chairperson and members of the committee. My name is Johansen and Jeffers. I'm the Deputy Chief Economist at the Reserve Bank. My boss, Governor Marcus, actually asked a great apology for not being personally available to attend to today's proceedings. But as one of the economists, she asked me then to make a presentation and also to convey any further questions there might be and to take it back to the Reserve Bank for further discussion and investigation to the extent that the committee deems it worthy to do so. Anyway, I was hoping then in the next 20 minutes to outline a few observations on the exchange rate of the rand from the letter which you wrote that was clearly the critical variable to be discussed. Also, a few words on the cost of capital in South Africa and in the related documentation that also seems to play an important role, and then I'll conclude. So, but for a starting on the exchange rate of the rand, some people call that the most important price in the economy. This is the history of the, since 1980, rand-dollar exchange rate. In this instance, a higher value means more rand per dollar, and so it means a weaker exchange rate, a weaker rand. And as the heading there says, well, this has gone from less than 1 rand per dollar to more than 7 rand per dollar, which from a competitiveness point of view one should interrogate, of course. The question then being, does this movement from less than 1 rand to more than 7 rand, sometimes it was more than 12 rand, even 15 rand, 84 at the high point, mean a sevenfold increase in the competitiveness of South African goods? But with a sad answer, and unfortunately that is not the case, one should at least also bring inflation into consideration in assessing competitiveness. And the prices in the US stay unchanged. The prices here in South Africa rise roughly 7-fold. Then the rand price of $1 should really go up also 7-fold. So for that reason then, that the economists tend to focus on the so-called real exchange rate. That is then a concept which adjusts the nominal exchange rate, the ordinary quoted exchange rate, for the inflation differential between the two countries. So there's actually a formula, which is not a horribly difficult formula to figure out, which shows how this is calculated. So it's the dollars per rand, which you have to multiply with the price index in South Africa in rand, as compiled by Statistics South Africa, divided by the price index in the US in dollar, as compiled by their authorities in America. So if you do that calculation, then you get an indication of how strong or how weak the rand really is after taking inflation into consideration. And if one now does this calculation just for US dollars, not for other currencies, but just against US dollars, then one finds that this graph shows us that from 1980, from that very high point over there of the real exchange rate of the rand, strong rand is higher on this graph, from that very high point, there was a big decline up to more or less the mid-1980s, quite a big recovery subsequent to that, huge further decline up to 2001 December, quite a bit of a recovery after that. And currently, I say that value now is not very far from the long, long run average of the real exchange rate of the rand against the US dollar. So that's the first thing in assessing competitiveness which one has to do, correct for inflation differentials. But the second thing is not to focus on just on currency. One should actually be mindful of a world with many currencies, and so one should look at the effective exchange rate, which again, of course, sure can down a lot. Against the basket of currencies, this rand has really depreciated a lot. A very fierce decline during the 1980s. It feels a bit smoother from the mid-80s to 2000, but since it's not the same log scale, it's not quite comparable, but then it's more sideways during the past 10 years or so, as our inflation came under control. So if you just focus on the most recent past, just interrogate the past 3 years or so, this is the picture which one gets, again, for the damaging the basket of currencies. One finds, for instance, that there was really big excitement in 2008 with the international financial crisis when the exchange rate fell, and then it fell much further when the Lehman Brothers failure made investors scared. So what happened? It seems that investors, well, although the problems actually originated in America and to some extent in the UK and in the mature markets, but in America, especially with Lehman, when there was this failure and uncertainty, people retracted to where they were comfortable, where they knew the terrain, or where they thought at least they knew the terrain, where they thought their government would protect them in some wonderful way. And so it was a flight to familiarity. And despite the problems being in America, money came back to America, went out of emerging markets like South Africa, and that is why the rand then actually fell together with many other emerging market currencies during this period. But quite a bit of a recovery subsequent to that, as fundamental forces again started to be more important later on. So now this is then probably the most important graph I will be showing today, which is then the real effective exchange rate of the rand. It's against the basket of currencies and it is adjusted for inflation. So not just one currency, it's a big basket and it's adjusted for inflation. Again, the stronger rand is up, and we can just go through a few episodes here in the past. I think the instruction is actually to think a bit about what this must have done for our industrial development. And now quite clearly, the early years here, when the gold price was very good, was probably a classical case study in Dutch disease, where the very strong exchange rate, because of mining, made industry extremely uncompetitive. and therefore there were numerous protective measures in place at the time, very high import duties and the like, but despite that, manufacturing did not flourish and could certainly not penetrate export markets without real special assistance. So that was a really extremely high level, and I think one must say at this stage that such extremes are not good at all for industrial development and obviously for it. But then after that, yeah, during the 1980s, because of the government apartheid policies, financial sanctions, the debt standstill in the mid-1980s, big movements down in the real effective exchange rate, of course in a way being more competitiveness, but those foreign markets were increasingly closed to South African exports, and so there was no flourishing of industry under the circumstances. Well, moving on then to the democratic period, financial rand was abolished within 1995, March, if I remember correctly. Just one or two other incidents, rumors regarding President Mandela's health in 1996 actually triggered that depreciation of the rand. There were some other discussions and debates at the time. The year policies also came to the fore at that stage. Then the next really big downward move was the Southeast Asian crisis, 1998, which you might all remember vividly, quite senior times. Then in 2001, there was this severe speculation against the rand, which was also the topic of our whole commission of inquiry and many more writings and so on. So anyway, that saw the rand depreciating. Just before Christmas in 2001, it went as far as about 13.84 for $1, but that was just on one day, a few transactions. So, however, these were real extremes which were recorded over there. From that, there was this huge appreciation again in the exchange rate of the rand, recovery, as some people call it. Moving on then, there was this Lehman failure. And I think, yes, that is probably more or less the story which I would love to highlight. I can say so much actually about each year in the chronology, but rather it does not go there. Some of the important drivers of the exchange rate of the rand obviously have to do with the terms of trade, export earnings. So when the gold price was high, now remember in 1980, $600 then or $800 then was not the same as $600 or $800 now. The purchasing power of that was much more at the time. So that was a huge inflow of money. The gold industry also at that time was much bigger than currently the case. And so the foreign currency flowing into the country in the early 1980s created this, well, psychology, but also cash flows, which made for a very strong appreciated exchange rate, which was really good for importers, but not so good for exporters, and certainly not good for industry. So it was nice and juicy in the gold industry, but not so much in industry more generally.
Which have been quite juicy and which have rendered some support and confidence
which I obtained to support the currency value at the moment. I think one should also recognize as a short-term driver the ebb and flow in international investment into South Africa. So again, one can state that flight to familiarity episode of 2008 with Lehman, which actually saw money leaving South Africa, leaving many other emerging markets and going back to the mature markets, and that certainly helped the exchange rate to go down quite a bit. So, but subsequent to that, of course, things started to normalize. Confidence and business as usual started at least to return to some extent. And so, in 2009, we really found that again, where previously there was an outflow in 2008, to actually bring a return to nice inflows of portfolio capital into South Africa, which again tended to support the rand. So, the new interest came back. If one compares the story of the rand with that of a number of other currencies, well, of course, if one looks at the value of the rand relative to the American dollar, one finds that actually with 2000, beginning of 2008, we've actually depreciated more than the other. But in a certain way, we have become more competitive, but you should adjust that again for inflation to tell the true picture. However, just look at what happened to the crisis situation of 2008 once again, and one would see that we are clearly not alone. Many other currencies have the same fortunes as the South African rand. Quite a decline in late 2008, early 2009, and quite a recovery subsequent to that. This actually even helps if we do the comparison with the BRICS, except for China. So Brazil, Russia and India, they all have the same pattern, then followed by recovery. The Chinese currency is restoring its own right, and I'm sure that this committee has done many studies and is quite interested in what they have been doing, but they certainly have an extremely interventionist approach to the foreign currency market. What can one say about the relationship between the exchange rate of the currency and the fortunes of our industry of manufacturing? Well, one indicator of how good industry is doing, I guess, is to look at manufacturing GDP as percentage of total GDP. And in most countries, actually, one tends to find that the services sector becomes more important by the time, and manufacturing perhaps not that. And so for South Africa, it is perhaps not that huge a surprise that our industry, manufacturing at least, currently quite a bit smaller than before. But there are also special other factors, which are certainly not much related to the exchange rate of the currency. During the 1980s, it was still the isolation economy at the time, given the political situation. There were lots of strategic industries that had really high levels of protection. At various points in time, for instance, rates of import duty on fairly basic things of 30%, 40%, on motor vehicles it was 100%, and actually there was on top of that at some point in time a surcharge which may be 115%. Now those import duties have been have been gradually reduced to lower levels. And, of course, that made for more competition, more difficulty, no longer hiding behind the strategic industry argument, and that also perhaps led to the decline in the share of manufacturing in our total GDP. The relationship between the effective exchange rate and the share of manufacturing, therefore, is not the one which one would expect. So, purely statistically, if you just look at those two variables, the relationship is actually fairly weak. That does not say, however, because correlation does not prove causality, that does not say that the real effect of the exchange rate is unimportant, not at all, rather the reverse. The real exchange rate is indeed extremely important, but other factors also enter into this picture, and that is the one frustration of economists, perhaps, that one always has to say that there are many factors which influence, rather than just one. And looking at just one factor to tell you the whole story and the whole history and explained it eloquently or not is not the way to go. And this means shows the real growth rates of manufacturing. As one can see that there are correlations which are extremely tenuous in this instance and sometimes clearly, clearly absent. Here one would actually expect from conventional theory that if the real effect of exchange rate is very strong, then manufacturing GDP growth would be slow. So high values for the green line, low values for the blue line. Now you find that sometimes it works and sometimes it does not work. More importantly, one should also recognize that there should actually in real life be lags. You don't change the exchange rate today and tomorrow people start to export more or export less. It takes time to develop markets, so there's something structural which is far more important than the short-term volatility. Here is one more indicator of manufacturing fortunes, which is capital expenditure in manufacturing. Again, very difficult to see any good correlations there to speak of. For instance, here we saw a really strong real effective exchange rate, and there was fairly strong at the time fixed investment in manufacturing. To some extent, however, that had to do with the Sasol plants, which were being erected in the early 1980s. They were driven more by the price of petroleum and by strategic decisions which were taken in the late 70s. So, again, to correlate that and say that the real exchange rate was the driver is certainly not correct. Well, we have a quite diverse manufacturing. There's many elements in manufacturing. To pull it all down to Sasol is, of course, again, a post-service of education. But generally, one can make the point that the correlation between the exchange rate and fixed investment in manufacturing is not too strong at all. Now, confidence and income and sales are actually more important determinants of capital expenditures more generally, along with the cost of finance too, of course. And so, again, confidence rather than the exchange rate is very important. The exchange rate sometimes, of course, does also give an indication of confidence, so one should not also forget that channel through which there is a relationship. But again, one would be finding it very tenuous to make big arguments that the real exchange rate really drives fixed capital formation in manufacturing. I can just illustrate the point that the fall in manufacturing production and exports in 2008 and 2009 had very little to do with the exchange rate. No, it was a horrible decline felt in most parts of the world, and it was driven by the international financial crisis and not by exchange rates. Of course, to the extent that now we saw a weak international market, with sales for everybody falling, under those circumstances, of course, there was no and the exchange rate being recovered in 2009 was relatively unfavorable further. That made the double hurt, I think, to producers who wanted to export because the export demand has left gone. Not that whether the exchange rate was very favorable or very unfavorable for exports, the demand was simply not there. Right through the world, production processes had actually been scaled down quite a bit. And so it was hard more or less regardless of the exchange rate. Make a few points about maintaining stable and competitive level of the exchange rate of the rand. Can anybody be against this? No, of course not. To maintain a stable and competitive level of the exchange rate of any currency is really just sensible. So that is very much agreed with me also as far as good policy advice is concerned. As far as stability is concerned, if you have small shivers in the exchange rate, the rand goes from 7.50 to 7.40 to 7.55 to 7.35 per US dollar, that's not really where the big trouble lies. From an allocation point of view, that's still the same order of magnitude. Your profits will not be changed that much, and you can really happily hedge against that. No, it's where the big number changes. It becomes not 7 rand to the dollar, but 10 rand to the dollar, or 5 rand to the dollar. Then, of course, now things which were previously very profitable become unprofitable, or things which were previously less avoided become very juicy. So it's for the big magnitude changes with interfering happen. And there are ways to hedge against even that. Fairly deep forward market in South Africa, so it's possible to hedge, but you don't just want to hedge. If you commit to a manufacturing or industry concern, you actually are looking at many years of profits and costs, and so you would love to see things on a sustainable basis to be profitable. We believe that it's very good for a more stable level of the exchange rate of the rand to have a robust financial system, a well-developed financial system, to strengthen our international financial ties, and then what we have also seen is the raising of foreign exchange reserves. That also gives confidence. It takes a bit of shakiness out. You don't want South Africa to be ranked in the economy stable as a country with the lowest foreign currency reserves in the world, relative to imports. You actually want it to be seen as fairly normal. And so to raise foreign exchange reserves is also good for confidence and indirectly for stability. One can make the point that over the recent history, only since 1994, since democracy, looking at that period, there seems to have been a little bit of a reduction in the volatility of the currency. Of course, the 2001 episode stands out as a matter of huge volatility. And that was really a horrible time, so no doubt that this was one of the most horrible volatility performances of our currency. Subsequent to that, well, at least the volatility has declined somewhat. And we do believe that some of the things to make our financial system more robust have been helpful towards that end. As far as the level is concerned, also varying, it's not small changes, but big changes which we will be concerned about. Big overshoots, going too strong or going too weak. Then, unfortunately, one must be modest and say that there is no such thing as a long-term number, magical number, which is the equilibrium exchange rate of the rand in real terms, in nominal terms, or in any terms, simply because there are so many impacts on the exchange rate and on the equilibrium exchange rate of the rand. If the terms of trade should shift on a permanent basis, like discovered new oil, new oil deposits in the world, and the price comes down to $20 per barrel once again, and there is some wonderful new demand for platinum, and the price goes up to $4,000 per ounce, you would find that then on a permanent basis, there would be kind of a windfall to our terms of trade, and the equilibrium exchange rate could change. So it is not a static concept, it could tend to evolve over time. And for that reason, it is kind of dangerous to target a specific level of exchange rate for at the only level and say that that is all the history just there will be fine. So there are many things actually between the millions of participants in the foreign currency market, from tourists to big financial speculators, which make for the exchange rate not being a static equilibrium process. It's definitely difficult to recognize misalignment. It's really difficult to call the shot and say that now it has gone too far, up or down. That is really quite difficult. So you would find that economists write long articles with various concepts, with various ways of judging when the alignment of the exchange rate is adequate, when it's in equilibrium or not, and various models give you various results, different results. However, let us suppose that one can spot the misalignment of the exchange rate, as I would propose perhaps we certainly saw in 1980 and 83 in our long ago history, what can be done. And there are a number of things which can be done, and I'll just deal with them one by one. So one is just to disseminate factual economic information about the situation, to make the point that this is an extremely high level of the exchange rate, it's never been there before. It does not seem to be supported by this and this and this fundamental statistic and so on and so forth. Now, actually, already in South Africa, there's quite adequate statistical dissemination, at least, around the foreign currency market and about the economy in general. One can also try open-mouth policy And say that, hey, you know, the exchange rate has become too strong. The exchange rate is now really on the weak side. And say, you know, just consider, it's now the highest it has been in 20 months, the lowest it has been in so many years. This seems like an overshoot. Are you aware that in the importer and exporter community and in the financial community that this is now a new exchange? By highlighting that, you can perhaps to some extent bring sense to the market, but it can also have perverse consequences. So there's no joy in this too, because the market can take you on and say, now, before you put your money where your mouth is. Then exchange controls can also be an instrument used towards addressing suspected misalignment of the exchange rate. This, again, unfortunately, is not an instrument which comes without complication. You don't know what the lags will be and what the uptake will be. Let us say there's today the realization of the amount of money which South Africans can take out of South Africa, for instance. How many people will take up that offer? That would be informed by personal views of many individuals, which you cannot kind of throw easily or just ask one of the Nielsen agencies to do it for. And it's very difficult to quantify that. And there are lags also, administrative lags, lags in order to get the tax certificate to allow you to take the money out and so on. So many complications there. And then, of course, the business repulsion, if you tighten, can also have unintended consequences. South Africa, do we want to be an unfriendly investment destination, more features and so on. The point must also be made that South Africa needs foreign saving. We actually do have a saving shortfall. Our investment is now more than our savings by a fairly substantial amount, and for that reason this little tap is not one which should be looked at in a negative light, but foreign investment is actually helpful. What is interest rate changes? As a matter to address the exchange rate misalignment is suspected, there unfortunately it runs in different directions. If the interest rate goes up, then perhaps for the person wanting to put deposits into South Africa, it makes it more juicy and attractive. But for the person who wants to do share investment into South Africa, where the interest rate is higher, that person might think, South African profits will now be lower, so let me sell my shares in South Africa. So unfortunately, the interest rate has different effects in the equity and in the interest-seeking markets, and for that reason, one should be quite cautious not to do both things with policy interest rates in the hope that that will resolve the balance of payment situation. And then finally, purchase or sale of foreign currency. There is a unequal outcome in this. In that if you are selling foreign currency, if the authority, the Reserve Bank sells foreign currency, we can actually run out of foreign currency. The pile of dollar in our vault can be depleted. But on the other hand, if we buy foreign currency, then of course we can continue printing the rand to buy that foreign currency forever. So there's in a way not a limit to that. But there is a cost. Let me just address that quite quickly. But anyway, on balance, the South African authorities have increased our foreign reserve holdings quite substantially. It was about 8 billion 6 years ago. It's currently about 40 billion US dollars. This is dollars. And the rand terms times 7.5 is actually quite a part. And we've been buying up all the time, more or less, over this long war. And in that process, well, while the intention was not to target the exchange rate, we bought when the liquidity was there in the market, and one cannot deny that it also might have had price implications from time to time. I then just highlight that even if we purchase foreign currency by printing rand, then it has cost implications. If the Reserve Bank purchases a dollar from a bank, we pay with 750 newly printed banknotes, rand. So the rand circulation has increased. That would now tip the money market into a big surplus and let the money supply explode in a way. And so we have to sterilize the rand created in this way. So one mechanism, there are actually a few, but all of them cost money in a way. We can sell the Reserve Bank IOUs to banks and to the And so that became drained again, that 750, the 750 new notes was put into the system, but it now comes back to the Reserve Bank as we sell them these IOUs which are interest bearing. Government can also and does help by placing more money on deposit with the Reserve Bank instead of the private sector banks. But again, there's an opportunity cost. And so government might first tax that money away, find that money somewhere, issue more government bonds in order to collect the money to put on deposit with the Reserve Bank. So again, there's a cost to the country, to the public, and interest cost to the authorities. This is then the picture of how much intervention in the money market we have had to have in order to neutralize the liquidity created by purchasing all these foreign currency reserves. The red line shows what's been happening to our gross gold and foreign reserves. That's been going up all the time. The valuation index also now goes up and down. This one is in billions of rand, of course. And yet, down below you can see the instruments which have been used to drain liquidity. So the green little portion down below is the Reserve Bank's reserve repurchase agreements, which kind of short-term loans of the Reserve Bank. Reserve Bank debentures, which we issue to the public, whereby they buy it and then put the money with the Reserve Bank. And then the big one is government deposits for the South African Reserve Bank. That's been increased from tiny amounts 5 years ago to really quite substantial amounts nowadays. So all of these things, of course, they, in a certain way, cost interest. Now the problem is that on the gross global foreign currency reserves currently, if you hold US dollar or euro, the interest rate of the economy is perhaps 1 or 2% per annum. Whereas on these instruments over here, the typical cost associated with paying that liquidity would be the South African money market interest rate, which is now about 6.5%, it was higher previously. So it's actually a big interest rate differential, which is kind of tilted against the authorities. And so it costs us, it costs the taxpayers, to the money to sterilize liquidity. The rest of the distance between those two things are in a certain way costless, in that that was the increase in notes and coin in circulation and in the bank's reserve deposits with the central bank, which kind of explained the rest of the distance over there. That was kind of automatic stabilization which happened, and we were kind of happy for that. But that did not go in far enough, and so we needed these interventions to stabilize them. But that eventually South Africa pays for that sterilization. So to keep reserves is not costless, there are financial implications. In reflecting how much one can do in the foreign currency market, one should just be mindful that to change the exchange rate by intervening, by buying and selling foreign currency, you act in a very big and very liquid market. Now, this is actually the daily average turnovers in that market. That is per day. So the average daily turnover in that market, say, is about $10 billion on one day, which changes hands. Various types of contracts, spot contracts, and forward contracts, and swap contracts. So technically there are some differences there. But the bottom line is it's a very liquid and a very big market. Our total foreign currency reserves today, 40 billion, in a certain way, you would say that our total foreign currency reserves is equal to 4 days of transactions in the South African foreign currency market. So that's quite a big market, and that should moderate one's expectation of the impact which one can have buying and selling foreign currency. The thing is just very big, very big. One should not forget the opposite direction also. Running from the exchange rate to inflation in reflecting upon these relationships. So for instance there, in 2001, where the exchange rate of the rand fell so much, the inflation of course went up quite a bit because imported goods became very expensive. Similarly, when the exchange rate strengthened there and strengthened there, that helped to moderate inflation. Could I say a few things about the cost of capital in South Africa, since that was also argued in the related document as a factor making it difficult for industry to thrive. Just to make the point that perhaps in the document which was disseminated, or just taking one kind of instrument might not be enough. There's actually a lot which can be said about raising capital in South Africa. There are various instruments available, but if one focuses on loans and debentures, in a way, at least I think to be a bit closer to what the Reserve Bank has control over, it is certainly helpful if interest rates do not fluctuate excessively. One must really concede that one. And also say that from a cash flow point of view, helpful if the nominal interest rates are lower, not higher. Especially with front loading and so on, a nominal interest rate of 20% does make it more difficult for businesses to thrive than one of 10% or 12%. Sustainability, I think, is very important. So if it's a very low interest rate for a short time to entice you, and then it comes back at a much higher level later on and urge you, that is not the way to go. It does not make for sustainable policy or good economic decision. This is then, well, on the long-term borrowing side, an indication of what the Eskom bond yield has done since the mid-1960s. You can see how interest rates have gone up. We've also made an estimate of what the private sector bond yield would have been over that period. The private sector did not have much bond in circulation, so there's not enough readings to make for a good analysis thereof. But that would, the red line would probably have been roughly the rate at which solid private sector borrowers would have issued bonds. One can see just that big up, big, well, huge leap in interest rates during the 1970s and 80s, and then the rather big decline again later on. And that has a lot to do with inflation, of course, because the savers want to be compensated for inflation, so the higher inflation, the blue portion on this graph, gain support in the nominal level of interest rates, and then as inflation came down, that also created some room for long-term rates to come down. So the real Eskom bond yield, if you take the nominal one and you subtract inflation from it, this is the picture which one gets. In recent years, then, the real rates on the bond side have not been extremely high in South Africa, so that is perhaps favorable for the moment. But it's quite unfortunate that this has been so shaky over time, with such big amplitude over time. On the short side, the annual averages again of the nominal prime overdraft rate, very up and down during the 1970s and 80s, actually a bit more stable in recent years, I must say. And if one does the inflation adjustment again, one finds that, yes, at the moment, the prime overdraft rate is certainly not the lowest in history, but it is more stable and relaxed, and in a way, it creates a more stable and pleasant environment for lending business and borrowing business. Point to emphasize is that if one does any kind of analysis of policy interest rates, one should rather not take just a single moment in time, like the end of last year or the end of the previous year, should actually look at longer term averages and do cross-country comparisons, not just on one moment in time. This is an attempt over a 10-year period to calculate where real interest rates have been. As you can see here, South Africa is not at all the lowest in this ranking. It's on the higher portion of that. But given the inflation circumstances and other uncertainties and policy settings, it was just by the authorities to be sensible settings for South African policy interest rates. It's also not horribly high, I must say. I'm looking here at the real interest rate of below 3%, a little bit above 2%, which is not in the overall history of the planet such an extremely high level. And one finds that China and Brazil with very much more exciting financial ups and downs, has had higher real policy interest rates. Even China has quite somewhat higher average real interest rates over this period. In conclusion, I then say that, yes, also at the Reserve Bank, we really support the view that the stable and competitive exchange rate of the rand is quite crucial to appropriate industrial strategy. and they make the point that by building financial robustness, if you buy foreign currency reserves when the supply of foreign currency is strong, it's helpful. It reduces volatility and it also moderates undue appreciation of the rand. And that is more or less what the Reserve Bank is currently doing. One should not see that leaning against the wind or accumulation of a foreign currency as an attempt to target a specific level of the exchange rate. No, I think this is an attempt at moderating extremes, but to target a specific level of the exchange rate and say that we have these smart economists who have figured out that at 766.2 there is equilibrium in the foreign currency market, and so we target that level, that's not how it works. Economists are not up to such intelligence, unfortunately, and so we do not target a specific level of the exchange rate and would advise strongly against doing so. The size of the relevant market, the cost and risk attached to steering the rate to a specific level would just not be a good plan. International practice and also our domestic experience also not so favorable. We have, after all, had huge and bold attempts during the 1990s and 1980s to steer the exchange rate to specific levels with much more enthusiasm, and quite a few of those episodes ended in tears, so we would advise against targeting a specific level. The other problem, if one concentrates too much on the exchange rate, is that it could lead to neglect of supply side measures. We would also say that, yes, of course, on camera disagree, the cost of capital should be realistic, it should be unduly volatile, it should not be high. Financial stability and low inflation actually helps towards making the cost of capital less volatile and to bring down the nominal level of those rates. And so, again, that is more or less what our entire policies on the monetary side are intended to bring about. The stable environment where you have low inflation and a stable platform from which growth and development can continue. So we think that we can do better than this, and we would hope that we can contribute towards that end also by this financial stable environment and contained inflation. We do not think that instability and high inflation is the way to go, but we can bring to the party in a stable environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Members, we have asked the committee secretary to check again with the technical team, and perhaps he can just define that. But we didn't want to delay our engagement, especially as we already have the actual presentation of Panther. But for those members who were held up by passports, etc., that is the reason we are late at the moment due to technical problems. I also, just before I open up for questions, members, want to indicate that the representative from the Pan African Congress, the Honourable Ntatelele, is reminding me about the 51st anniversary, and he will be excusing himself now. We would like him to return. As soon as he's got to share with the cake. And the distribution is done wide. On that note, let's open up the questions and let me sum to others. So we can come again with the second word. Honorable Turok will be the first. Yes. Honorable Kadebe, second. And can I see yourself put the table? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much for a very useful presentation.
Let's recall the Reserve Bank coming to this committee before, and we haven't. And I want to welcome that. And it seems to me a sign that the Reserve Bank is breaking away from its traditional focus, which was rather narrow, and that the Reserve Bank is taking seriously the constitutional requirement that you take account of other issues than the exchange rate alone, or inflation alone, or the price stability issue, much as you've emphasized that. So I welcome that. And it seems to me that the Department of Trade and Industry badly needs a broader focus by the Reserve Bank for the IPAT to succeed. I have a number of points. You talk about stability. Now, China has a pegged rate to the dollar. So as the dollar fluctuates, Chinese rate, exchange rate fluctuates, even though the currency is pegged. So can you comment on that? That's obviously a sign of not wishing to move with the dollar. And therefore that has an effect on the performance of China. And when the currency is weak, or that affects the export capability of China and so on. So, you know, what's your comment on that? Clearly, a peg break doesn't lead to currency exchange rate stability. Does that mean, or am I wrong? So that's the question. You commented that the real exchange rate is not the only factor. As far as our trade is concerned, and in fact our industrial performance. But isn't it critical? Because it seems to me that where there are so many variables, one must, in terms of policy, and in terms of our desire to industrialize, come to some sort of view on what is critical. And I would have thought that even though many factors impact on the real exchange rate, on the economy, inflows and so on, the real exchange rate is a critical one, and it seems to me the bank should give that the highest possible priority. The question about the dual exchange rate, it seems to me that the fluctuations that you talk about, is the dual exchange rate totally out of the picture? Would it not be useful? Because in a turbulent world with a kind of shift that you portrayed, isn't it better to try and sort out your competitiveness issue from the financial flows? And also, I think you made a very important point, which people do not make. And that is, portfolio investment operates under different conditions to industrial investment. And the two seem to be opposed, as you indicated, that portfolio investment is dependent on high interest rates, industrial investment, which is going to grow the economy, which is IPAC, depends on the low interest rate. So, again, there, we have to choose what's our priority. You can't just say that the one balances against the other. We have to choose as a country where we go. And since we're talking about IPAC, clearly, low interest rate is good for the growth of the economy, with portfolio investment is very volatile, and who knows where it's going to go and what motivates it, as you indicate. You can come in, go out so fast, which is why some countries have adopted the hump, been up. Chile and Malaysia did it particularly strongly. So should we not give priority to low interest rates, because we're talking about IPAC right here and now. If I may, one more point, because I'll come back later. One more point. The competitiveness issue. It seems to me we have to distinguish between competitiveness in the domestic economy and competitiveness internationally. The two are so different. The requirements on the economy are so different. And I'd like your comment as to whether the Reserve Bank, while you talk about competitiveness, whether you disaggregate and differentiate between our need to be competitive internationally, which seems to be currently based on our mineral resources, which is a very unsatisfactory situation in many ways, and the competitiveness domestically, which requires a different policy instrument and a different stance by the bank. Fact check.
Thank you.
equipment and tools and manufacturing and machinery.
And obviously, for China, it might be good to have a very low exchange rate, and also inflation, obviously, with the same effect for everything there. They export everything, and we're just the opposite. What, in your opinion, can be done to look at that? Then the other thing about where we look at the real interest rates of banks, of the central banks, please give us the inflation rate of those countries like Brazil, China, the others as well. Because obviously, from a real interest point of view, that graph is exactly right. But from a nominal point of view, which is something that the, especially the small business, must deal with, and they are not really in the position to offset a lot of things against the inflation to look at the real interest rate. So possibly our challenge is inflation, and obviously getting inflation even lower. And to a certain extent, I agree with Uncle Turok that we need to grow the industry and IFAD. We obviously need lower interest rates. But that might be a conflict for you guys to get inflation lower. Just your comment on that as well.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions from members on my list? Yes, the Honourable Nchikalana, and then the Honourable Nchikalana.
So definitely, my first question is about the foreign exchange reserve. You make reference to one of your slides. Now, what are the reserves? What is the value? Is what would be an acceptable or a normal level of foreign exchange reserve? Number two, when it comes to foreign saving versus domestic saving, which one is more important for industrial development specifically? Lastly, you also made reference to our foreign exchange reserve, which is about 40 billion as a state and a country compatible with international liquidity policy. The question I have there is that what advantage does it have for ICAR? Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Ntashlele.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks so much for a great presentation. I have two short questions. In your presentation, you alluded that the Chinese have interventionist policy to stabilize their currency. My question is it a good thing to do? And we as South Africa, do we have some interventionist policy? Or do we sometimes have to step in and stabilize the current? Secondly, to what extent does one neighbor influence the strength or the weakness of the currency? Because out there, lay people like me conclude that the rand would be far much stronger if it had not been of the same dollar decline. Thank you.
Thank you. On the moment of the someone's got a cell phone on. Please switch it off.
Thank you, Comment Chair, for the input. Thank you, Comment Chair. My first question is what should we as a country do to motivate and to encourage savings? Because we are lagging behind compared to other countries. sense of broadening the savings. My second question relates to what the Honorable Mukhatela said. If we look at the other continents, they tend to come together so that, I mean, if we look at the development of the euro, what is your comment relating to what sometimes gets discussed, the unification of Africa, and from your perspective, it means we are speaking of a common currency. Will that advance our cause as a developing part of the world? And then the last one is the interest rates. Do they, in what way do they advance our cause or work against advancing our cause as they increase or decrease, versus inflation? I know my question has been asked indirectly by other members.
Thank you very much. Those of yourself now, Dr. Andiyeva, to respond to those, and I have quite a few of them. You may, if you wish, want to group some of the questions with a response. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Should I? Well, I think for a start, I'll go chronologically and see if there are overlaps. So as far as Professor Turok's first remark is concerned on China's stability with the PEP and the request to comment on it, yes, of course, by definition, that has now created extreme stability, at least of the one exchange rate. But, of course, you cannot peg against all currencies. Against a single currency or against a specific basket, that is a model which has been used, I guess, in a way successfully by China, and it has been pitched at levels which have been deliberately put at levels which make them extremely competitive. The cost, in a way, has been that they have accumulated foreign currency reserves on a scale which one cannot believe. We're talking $40 billion. They're talking $2,000 billion and counting. So it's very exciting in that country to be a reserve administrator on the case. It is also helpful if, in a way, the political processes are not very sensitive to the cost of accumulating all those reserves and actually seeing those reserves from time to time not performing very well. So in periods since most of their foreign currency reserves are held in American dollars, and American dollar now depreciates against other currencies, or if American investment markets go down, there is a cost which is in a way indirectly borne by the Chinese taxpayer, but I don't think in their system that is a great concern. So if you have a very deep pocket and a system which allows, that is perhaps a situation which one can contemplate. But not many countries around the globe actually do that. One must say that is rather the exception. And it is also an exception which is creating a lot of political excitement around that situation and pressures from other countries to discontinue and recognize, because what this eventually does is, of course, it does suppress consumption in China. One should not forget that the system there, in the end, in a certain way, is not consumer-friendly, it's producer-friendly, and that creates its own little tensions. But let the Chinese people and experts perhaps rather speak further on that before I answer that. Yes, but then, of course, in a certain way, that has certainly led to stability, at least planability in terms of trade which is denominated in US dollars. That is really quite easy for the Chinese, but not without its complications, as I indicated. Professor Turok asked if isn't the exchange rate actually the most critical of the various factors which make for economic success and for industrial success? Well, as with most things, I would argue that for economic success you need a chain of many links. If just one of those links is not there, then it doesn't help that the others are bright and sparkling and wonderful and very strong. So sadly, you can have a very lucrative exchange rate, perhaps, for export business, but if the railway is not there and the port is not functioning, then you do have a problem, as some other countries and from time to time ourselves have come to realize. So no, you need all these things to be in place. However, one should not ever underestimate the importance of the exchange rate to do that situation. And I would especially put it at the point of extremes. I think there's a kind of a moderate in-between area where the exchange rate makes the importers and exporters all unhappy. Then you find it right. It is, if it goes to overdrive and you find that the importers are all in heaven and the exporters all in hell, that one must be really mindful that now the exchange rate has moved to the point where it becomes the link which is broken in that chain. And so I think there should be that attention paid to it, but there should probably not be too much attention paid to it when it's in intermediate area. It's when it approaches new extremes, then I think the challenges do become a real great burden on any chance of industrial success. One should also again stress the point of sustainability and the fact that industrial decisions are long-term decisions, and they should not be taken on the basis of the exchange rate of one day. Should a dual exchange rate system again be contemplated? Well, the Reserve Bank had to administer that system, and it was very, very difficult. I must honestly say, to create two exchange rates, one for foreign investors and another one for South Africans, at the best of times, very, very difficult, I must say. It creates incentives for all kinds of schemes and scams and so on. The potential is actually almost endless if you allow enough time. If you do it as a surprise, just for 1 or 2 days, yes, of course, then it makes big changes and it looks quite innocent and successful. But after a number of months or years, when people have learned the rules of the game and how to get around them, it becomes really a horror and it creates the potential for, I think, many wrongful things to happen, which will pull down the economy instead of to uplift it. So now, in most instances, countries have moved to fewer or a single exchange rate, not in the opposite direction to multiple exchange rates. I would not advise going there. One should also remember that the exchange rate which was there, the dual exchange rate, the Finrand, it was actually supposed to help the exchange rate for importers and exporters to be stronger, not weaker. So in terms of wanting to export more, a dual exchange rate of that kind was actually the opposite of what one would actually like to have. It certainly did not help to promote exports. No, there's a differential between the Finrand and the commercial bank was in the wrong direction. Industrial investment needs low interest rates, portfolio investment needs high interest rates, so how do one balance that? That seems quite a challenge, of course, but the portfolio investment, I'm not so sure that it needs a high interest rate. As I said, for some kinds of portfolio investment, those that interest rate seeking as in depositors, wanting to put deposits inside South Africa, for bond investors wanting to have bond interest earnings. For them, yes, a nice high nominal interest rate can be good, and a high real interest rate even better for them. But for the share investors, and the share investors have been very important in recent years in South Africa, for the share investors, they probably want the opposite direction. A low interest rate for them is good because they see more company profits and more dividends being paid out in that way. So unfortunately, the high interest rate will not necessarily attract the capital. No, what you need is probably more a sustained, balanced growth path, a juicy economy where both depository investments, share investments, all the things are in a way balanced. confidence in the value of the money, you still also get the deposit and interest seeking type of investment. So I think one should actually not neglect any of those components of foreign capital flows into South Africa. To distinguish between international competitiveness and domestic competitiveness, yes, I think that's surely quite important to do. Mr. Adepi had a number of remarks, firstly on the competitiveness, and he mentioned the double-edged sword of firstly being for depositors, where low interest rates are not good, and of course for borrowers then low interest rates are good. How does one balance that? Yes, of course that's most important. It's really at the core of central banking and at having a balanced economy. You should not neglect either of those parties. For the economy to work, you need supply and demand. You need savers and borrowers. You should look after the interest of everybody. So everybody should be unhappy. The depositors must say that they're not getting enough interest, and the borrowers should say that they're paying too high interest. Then you know that probably the mix is more or less right. The way not to go is probably to have multiple interest rates. We have really complex systems with lots and lots of various schemes to protect this group and give them a special dispensation of this and that nature. That can easily escalate to a point where administration again becomes very, very difficult. So basics would simply be that your overall level of interest rate should be fair. There should be a real positive reward for savings. You should not have inflation at 10% and interest rates at 5%. Then you are killing the depositors and the savers, and you are subsidizing and helping the borrowers in a way which is not sustainable, because the savers will eventually go on strike. So you want to balance it in that way. Now the market will sort that one out in a certain way by pitching interest rates where there is actually savings as well as borrowers taking place. Again, with exporters and importers, the same story. The one would love a strong exchange rate, the other group would love a low exchange rate. In a way, again, you want those two piles of letters which come to the governor's office and to the Minister of Finance's office, those two piles should be equally high. Everybody should complain. Then you know that the exchange rate is probably more or less correct. And we have had events in the past from that real exchange rate graph where the letters were coming just from the one group or just from the other group. That is probably wrong. Did the financial rate system help? Well, I must say, I think the financial rate system as a buffer mechanism in terms of very sudden financial flows helped a little bit initially. But as it goes with direct interventionist things, they tend to be quite helpful for a short period, but when they become embedded and entrenched, they more and more difficulties. And also, I must say again, remember the financial rand was an attempt to keep money inside South Africa. What at least the export community now asks for is a more competitive exchange rate which will help them export. So they actually want this lower exchange rate. The financial rand, which was actually supposed to give us a higher exchange rate, would not have helped that cause at all. So I don't think that is the way to go, but also, as I said, it is a harder to administer. It is really a harder to administer. Not to be recommended, I would say. Then Mr. Marie. Yes, the remarks about South Africa's dependence on portfolio investment, why not other kinds of investment? How do we get that changed? Yes, of course, I think in the Reserve Bank, as everywhere else, one would welcome direct investment so much. That tends to be the bricks and mortar investment eventually. It brings with it expertise and know-how and international marketing linkages. Whereas portfolio investment is just arm's length by playing with stock exchange or the bond market or whatever. So of course one wants that. But how do you get that? You probably get that by creating a very nice environment of growth and nurture and stability. Well, I think one of the things which the industrial policy proposals now are exactly intended to bring about. A strong growth in the economy, which is not a flash in the pan and a brief one, but a long run of good and solid and sustainable development. That's the kind of environment where I think long-term interest, yes, I want to get the food out in this economy, where that motivation is enhanced. So we must really go for that. But again, don't look at the exchange rate alone to create that. All the elements which are in that industrial policy need to be looked at, and not just one, to create that environment. I must also say, however, that because we have the scarcity of savings, we've had a savings shortfall at some point in time of 7%, even 8% of GDP. Under those circumstances, there are such a big domestic savings shortfall, we must use foreign savings. And you cannot then choose and say, but I only want foreign direct investment, I don't want portfolio investment, or I cannot take deposit type investment into our country. If you don't save enough, you just have to take what comes in your direction. And so, unfortunately, I don't think we have the luxury of calling the shots at this stage. Once we have the strong growth run, sustainable growth and good employment creation will be better, and I think the FDI component will increase relatively. But not be the only pocket of money coming in. Can we get something like the Chinese stability of the exchange rate? Can any country get there? Well, at a price, I guess. If you are willing to take taxpayer money big time, as not billions, but billions upon billions, and sterilize and intervene and do very adventurous things, yes, I guess the sky is the limit, and you can do wonderful things in terms of controlling the currency, directing it, targeting a specific level, and so on. If the pocket is endlessly deep, and there are no other alternative uses for taxpayer funds, yes, I guess one can go that direction. But not many countries have the appetite for that, in all honesty, and I would certainly advise against it. Simply because of the cost incurred and the opportunity cost of going all out for that one single thing, and thinking that that one single thing will save and help and be the great savior. That is unfortunately not how it will be. As I said, I think the chain needs all the links to be in place, not just the exchange. On the real interest rates and the remark that the inflation rates behind those real interest rates should also be taken into consideration. Absolutely. And the very important point is that generally low inflation countries are also countries with low real interest rates. If you have more certainty, then you have much less worry about things getting out of hand. And some of those risk premium, which are built into the nominal interest rates, they go away or they are reduced. So your low inflation country with stable low inflation is also most likely a country with low nominal interest rates. And even without crooking the poor savers. You can actually have low inflation and stable low inflation. You can have positive real interest rates, so you help the savers by giving them a positive real return on their funds, but at the same time, the interest rate, the cash flow faced by the borrowers who want to do industrial investment is not excessively high. So, low inflation, to my mind, is actually a quite likable part of having a good economic formula, but at least that part of the growth is being supported by a very healthy environment. Mr. Chikalala had Chikalana. Corrected that, my apology. Had a question on the foreign exchange reserves, how much would be adequate? Now that is a very good question, I must say. How long is this thing, I guess one could ask. But there are a number of guidelines or guiding methods which one can use to fathom how much reserves there should be. One is to express it relative to imports and say how much money should we have in the kitty, dollar in the vaults of the central bank, to be able to withstand strange international circumstances, turbulence, or whatever, to create confidence and to just be generally financially prudent and sound. And so it used to be said that about 3 months' worth of imports would be okay. Now, actually, over the past 10 or 15 years, that philosophy in many parts of the world has changed towards the kind of, to the side of more caution. And so nowadays, that single number has tended to go kind of slowly up, and perhaps a bit more than 3 months, rather something like 5 or 6 months, is now viewed as perhaps admirable or good. There are some other ways of looking at it. Looking if your foreign currency reserves cover your short-term foreign debt. The foreign exchange reserves, of course, are assets of South Africa. The foreign debt is a liability. And the idea is then to have enough money in the vault so that even if we stop other transactions, we are able to at least pay back 1 year all the payments on our foreign debt due within 1 year. So that would be another criterion. Now, there are also kind of computer model econometric methods to assess likely volatilities and try to have in simulation not too many scenarios where you run out of reserves, which gives you kind of further quantitative answers to how much reserves should be kept. However, the short and sweet of it is that about $40 billion is, according to our judgment, not very far off the mark of where it should be tentatively comfortable. In a way, as I said, one can always be more cautious and always make a case for lifting us a little bit further up in the ranks of reserve-keeping nations, but currently the South African authorities, I think, are not too unhappy with the position where it currently is. At 8 billion, there was a clear red light. That was not a good plan. At 40 billion, perhaps there is much more relaxed spirit now surrounding this. Not to say that this is the end, that everything is hunky-dory. No, more can still be done. I think one more side remark is that one should also be mindful of the exchange rate dispensation. If you have a currency peg, then you need much more foreign currency reserves than if you have a floating exchange rate system, as we have. But my bottom line is perhaps that around $40 billion, perhaps a little bit more than that, the South African situation seems fairly well contained. Yes, which interest rate is the most relevant for industrial development? Well, I must say, looking at industrial development in many parts of the world, one finds that very often retained earnings is a really important mechanism for financing. So retained earnings, in fact, is so often where the funding comes from. But more generally, if it's borrowing, which is at stake, borrowing of money, then one would guess that long-term interest rates are more relevant than short-term interest rates. After all, industrial concerns are erected to be there for many years, for many decades, to make profits over many decades, actually. And so therefore, to kind of borrow at on a check overdraft where it's callable by the bank and it's a fluctuating interest rate to fund a project which has a 20-year lifespan, that's not such a good plan. So my guess would be that the longer term funding and bond funding would be perhaps more important. However, that would very much depend on the entrepreneur and the project on the case. With foreign exchange reserves at about $40 billion, as it currently is, be advantageous for the industrial policies of this country? Yes, of course. We have come from very shaky, very limited foreign currency reserves, where at least that element of assurance was not there. So, and that did make for a soft bend which can much more easily be heard by a changing international sentiment, by a change in the terms of trade, by many things which can go up and down. So the foreign exchange rate of the rand was much more subject, I think, to impacts, short-term impacts from other things which can destroy confidence and make it do really big moves. With more money in the kitty, at oxidation, that element of assurance is there, and I think that gives less volatility on the exchange rate side and better planability, and just generally a sense of more confidence. The South Africans know what they're doing. They have prudent reserves, they have a prudent financial system, they're okay, and so there's no need to run away at high speed the moment that there's some bad news. This also then, I think, touches on the question which Mr. Pashlele had about neighbours. Does our neighbour or neighbours have an impact on our exchange rate? Now, again, it depends. I think if you have shaky reserves and the own dispensation which is not mature, which is not well entrenched, if you don't have a constitution, if you are still negotiating everything is very fluid, then it's a different story. Then some bad news across borders can very easily spill over into South Africa and can create overshoots. On the other hand, if you have a more mature system, the constitution is there, the rules of the game are clear, the financial economy seems to be sound, and there's actually plans being made which seem sensible, then I think it's quite different. And so we have had previously in some of the 1990s episodes where bad news from Zimbabwe, at least according to some traders, did have a bad impact on the South African rand. But after that, in later episodes, that isolation, the dividing line between the system in our neighboring countries and in South Africa was much clearer. So the rating agencies and the international participants in the South African market became wise. They just did their own work and they realized that it's totally different systems and that the cross-pollination is actually so limited that it's basically absent. And therefore, in some of the more recent events which did not instill confidence coming from the north, the South African rand was really unaffected. It was seen as something totally different. To have Chinese stability of the exchange rate, the advantages thereof, and what should we perhaps do? As I indicated before, the advantage is very good planning ability and very easy hedging, knowing where you are going if you are doing business in US dollars. Not necessarily with other currencies, but if you are doing your business or invoicing in US dollars, it does help towards greater planning. And of course, by pitching the exchange rate perhaps at a very low level, you are helping the exporters, but you're not helping the importers or the consumers. So in terms of balancing the mix of interest in the economy, that has its own little agendas and political problems attached to that. What should we do? As I said previously, my own suggestion would be that rather we do not try to peg the rand or target a specific level of the exchange rate of the rand. And then one should always be wary that whatever system you have, if you peg against one currency, you are still floating against others, and that will from time to time then cause different kinds of trouble. So perhaps you can be perfectly competitive against the US dollar, but if the US dollar then appreciates excessively against the euro, then you now have trouble exporting to Europe. So there are these things to consider. Mr. Mabasa asked very importantly, and that's music to my ears, just the clear intent behind that question, worry about savings. What should we as a country do to encourage savings? It's so important. It is unfortunately a very quiet group in society, not very well organized. It's almost as if the borrowers are the only people in the country. And the savers are, because they are generally very old people and very quiet, they don't count. That's most unfortunate. No, we should as a country do much to encourage savings, and that can be done in a variety of ways. Most importantly, to my mind, the stable financial environment again. An environment where high inflation eats up your savings, it just makes a laughing stock of people who save. Subsidizes and helps those who borrow, and that is a really bad plan. So, containing inflation and a stable environment, tax laws which are fair and which do not excessively pounce upon the returns on savings. That would be important elements of having a good savings culture and a good savings environment. One should also certainly say that, most importantly, a growing economy. We should return to a growing economy. If the cake is shrinking, to now ask a person with declining income to save from their declining income, that's almost impossible. Now, you want growth in the economy, more people to work, more people who can belong to retirement funds, more people who can save. Yes, they'll borrow also, some of them, but they will save. And that's most important. So a growing economy is actually, in the long run, the thing where we should most importantly focus on. That will help with more savings and more investment and better life living standards for everybody. In other continents and areas, you find that currency blocks have been formed and those people are now enjoying the benefits of a single currency. Like in Euroland, here of course around South Africa we have the CMA, the Common Monetary Area of South Africa, the Switzerland in Swaziland, which is also the smallest grouping but also with one-to-one exchange rates and monetary policy which is centralized across these countries. Will that be helpful for Africa as a whole? Well, a number of remarks there. If you have countries which are extremely dissimilar and in terms of physical distance very far apart, it becomes very difficult to have a single exchange rate. Simply because those countries have patterns of production which are so dissimilar. If all the countries are well-developed, mature markets, where the services sector is important, the manufacturing and agriculture perhaps no longer so important, means it's a bit easier. But if there are countries which have very dissimilar patterns of production, it is most difficult. For instance, if you have in the same block a country which is a big oil producer, the one, and you have another country which is a big oil importer, and now the price of oil suddenly goes from the current level of $80 per barrel to $200 per barrel. I don't know if that ever happens. But anyway, now the country with the oil exporting capacity will have a lot of money flowing in. Naturally, it would have raised the exchange rates level and make it cheaper to import so that they can import more goods and services and enjoy a higher standard of living. But being in one block with another country which is an oil importer, that option is no longer there. So now the good luck is now translated into the need for people to migrate from the now lower income country to the now higher income country. And traveling cross borders, relocating is not such an easy thing. So the frictions of life in a currency block can be actually elevated instead of reduced. Yes, there's a big advantage to trade. If you are a tourist, if you go cross border, it's very nice to have a single currency. But if you are looking at countries with dissimilar production structures, it is much more difficult. For that reason, I would say that the first thing for Africa is to get the trade mechanisms and the financial markets to be well-functioning, so that it's easy to exchange money and easier to move around and easy to trade, and that they're not horribly high import duties and so on between countries and other barriers to trade. Trade is enhanced and financial flows are enhanced in different currencies. And later on, perhaps, to move towards a single currency for big parts of Africa or for the whole of Africa, perhaps, one day. But as long as production structures are very dissimilar, then one should not unduly press that particular option. Yes. Finally, in what way do interest rates advance a cause of causing more industrial development? What can interest rates really bring to the party? Well, I think one can say that of course we want in the long run for all South Africans, not just those in industrial development, but those who are homeowners and those who have any kind of business, you want predictability and you actually would love to see sustainably low interest rates, but low for the right reason. If you have low inflation and stability, There's a risk premium that goes up of the interest rate, and the nominal interest rate is also low. So the cash flow of the borrower is okay. At the same time, the saver gets a positive return on his or her investment in real terms, and in a certain way, the interest of balance of borrowers and of savers. With high interest rates, I'm afraid, with high inflation, high interest rates are the result, eventually, and it makes the cash flow fortunes unhappy of those borrowing, and it makes the industrial prospects also, the financing thereof, a bit more difficult. But I would be actually the last to say that the interest rate is also the magic element of strong industrial development. Now, again, one needs this whole chain, where everything should be there, the infrastructure, the manpower, the training, the finance, everything should be there. Sound rules of the game and certainty, that is what helps towards optimal development. There are not a single element, I'm afraid. But the interest rate is there, it is important, it is one element of that chain. And of course, if you dash it, if you neglect it, if you allow it to climb through the roof or to fall through the floor, in both instances, the consequences would be disastrous.
Thank you very much, Dr. Matehirma. Members, as I said earlier, we have run late due to a lot of technical problems that arose, and we certainly want to apologize to Dr. Christopher Lundell-Dubot. We are going to be having a team there for 10 minutes or so, and on our return, we'll open up with National Treasury and ask you to set yourself up. Meanwhile, thank you.
Yeah, I will actually try to be quite brief. Fortunately, going after Dr. Clinton, he's going to make life quite a lot easier because he's so thorough. And my presentation did overlap quite a bit. So I will focus on slides where I think there's something slightly different to say. Again, about primarily about the exchange rate and some of the implications of the economy of the exchange. So, just a few slides to begin with showing some of the recent data and some long-run data as well. This slide starts with the nominal exchange rate of South Africa, Brazil, New Zealand, Australia, beginning of January 2008. And running till about November 2009, I see it at the end there. And you can see what happened in the financial crisis. Eventually, the exchange rate were all sort of moving in tandem, and then the crisis hit, and everybody depreciated, and upward movement to depreciation there. Depreciated very sharply. South Africa depreciated by more than most. And then you can see the gradual normalization of the exchange rate levels in subsequent months as the world economy stabilized and as investors re-looked to put their assets back into emerging market economies. This is really one of the major different features of this crisis compared to some of the previous crises is this very rapid movement back into emerging market assets. By capital coming out of London and New York and from the other capital centers. This gives you a very long run view starting in 1990 of the nominal and the real effective exchange rate. You will remember this from Johan's presentation or a variant of it. You can see that the nominal exchange rate is depreciated in this slide, downward movement in the depreciation, just to keep you thoroughly confused. You can see a quite long-run trend of nominal depreciation culminating in January 2001-2002 with the Argentine crisis where the rand got hit quite badly and then a climb back over the subsequent years peaking in about late 2004, early 2005, the nominal exchange rate strengthened to a peak and then started to depreciate again since then. And then we've had these quite large jumping around with the global financial crisis, which you can see right at the end there. The real effective exchange rate has also been fairly jumpy, but it's over a long-term trend, it's been more stable. Again, you can see in 2001-2002 how the effect of the nominal exchange rate depreciating sharply also pulled down the real effective exchange rate, and then you can see it coming back up. This is the long-term trend of the nominal exchange rate since 1990 against the dollar, the pound, and the euro. And again, to now reverse things again for you to a rise appreciation. And you can see how over the very long term, of course, the rand has actually depreciated quite a lot. That's a line drawn just to give you a sort of linear sense of the direction of the currency. That's probably about 200% appreciation since 1990. And then if you look at the euro since 2000, you can see it's also in quite a strong depreciation over that period, on average, with the volatility of the peak. Trends against other emerging market currencies. Here I've got the rand against the rupee, which is the gray line. Hard to see, I apologize. Against the renminbi, which is the bright red line. And then against the Brazilian real, which is the reddish balloon line. And again, you can see that over time there's been quite sustained appreciation of the rand against some of these emerging market competitors. Now, where you want to draw the line, where you want to say that Iran should have been has a big influence on some commentators' perspectives on whether or not the endpoint is more depreciated or appreciated relative to the peak of these movements. But on the long term, I think the transfer is quite clear. That is against the Renminbi. I tried to sort of get a line in here between January 2000 and January 2010. Again, to show that's probably about 25% depreciation against the Renminbi over those 10 years. So, purely on a nominal basis, the Rand is actually depreciated against the number. 34% against the Renminbi, dollars, 20% the euro, 35%. So, it's quite large depreciation. What about exchange rate movements in manufacturing production? This shows you, as opposed to an index of the exchange rate, this shows you the actual percentage changes in the real and nominal rates, which are the gray and the brown series. And then the black line in the middle, wobbling around the zero mark, is your manufacturing production. So that's actual production. And you can see, in the period from 2001 through 2003, you had very sharp appreciation and appreciation. We also had very high interest rates. You had also very low confidence in the economy and a lot of uncertainty. And you can see the manufacturing production in that period actually declined slightly, basically in that area that I've shaded. And while the, sorry, and then you've got also the end point, 2009, obviously, this is the impact of the global crisis. Collapse in world trade, collapse in manufacturing production, collapse in demand around the world, and South Africa's manufacturing production, not surprisingly, has also fallen very, very sharply. But it's harder when you look at this graph to really find particularly strong correlations between the different sort of movements. When we look at the econometrics that we run on these kinds of series, we find that the manufacturing production corresponds with periods of international financial crisis. We find that short-run exchange rate movements are not correlated with major increases or decreases in production. But in the long run, exports and production rises as the real exchange rate appreciates. So if you do some statistical analysis on the brown line and the black line, you'll find that there's some positive correlation there. This circle area is an interesting sort of bit because it shows manufacturing production climbing quite steeply as it was coming out of the 2003-2002 period, even though the Rand was actually strengthening at the time. So the movement above zero shows the Rand strengthening while manufacturing production increases. It's very hard. Johan made this point. It's very hard to systematically say that there's a link between any particular movement in the exchange rate and any particular movement in manufacturing production. You have to look at these things over a very long time frame. I've got a few graphs in here, slides I want to go through very, very quickly. This is just a definition of the exchange rate. Johan also has a similar sort of exposition, walk us through it. What I'm about to show you is to try to break down in quite a simplistic kind of way what happens when the nominal exchange rate appreciates and sort of what you want to think about when the economy is responding to some kind of exchange rate shock. I'm not going to go through it. I'll leave it here for you to look at. It's not complete. There are bits and pieces of things missing. It's very hard to capture all the movements in the economy. Let me just make two or three points here quickly. The first column just shows you the shock, so the nominal exchange rate goes up or down. Second column shows you something about the immediate effect. The real exchange rate is one of the things that moves quickly, and then import prices start to rise, and then things like debt stock and rand start to rise. The second round effect, so this is literally thinking about what happens to the economy over time. Exports may start to rise as the exchange rate is depreciated. Imports may fall. Domestic prices might rise and interest rates might go up. And that first sort of set of columns inflationary impact of depreciating. When you have depreciation, it's the impact is deflationary. When prices rise, consumption falls. What you want to have happen is non-tradable goods fall and tradable rise, but it doesn't always work out that way. Because what happens subsequently in the third round, you can have real wages going up in response to domestic prices going up. You can have interest rate payments and debt rising further. And you get a sense of your reaction to the depreciation by the economy. And then you end up with your net effect. There are lots of them, I won't go through all of them. There's a couple that are particularly important. So what happens to the real exchange rate after the depreciation filters its way to the economy? Question is there a reversal of relative prices? So if domestic prices rise greater than foreign prices, then the real exchange rate actually appreciates. If unit labor costs, which are a function of wages and productivity, goes up, then exports can actually fall. And much about investment really depends on what the relative rates of return in tradables and non-tradables. So if the rate of return is seen to permanently rise in tradables, then you may get a permanent increase in tradables production as opposed to non-tradables. What about consumption? Well, if income from exports is higher than the income that used to be attained from the higher level of non-tradables and the increase in debt costs, then you might get changes in consumption. But it's very hard to know up front whether that's positive or negative. So I put this all in really to just make the point that much of these dynamics are really actually quite complicated and dependent on what happens by various economic agents after the change in policy and the shock to the exchange rate. Some of the evidence for South Africa, so accumulating all of what I just tried to briefly explain, what do we get? What does the historical data show us? Well, does export and import competing production permanently increase? Yes, depreciation events are followed by a rise in exports, but there's no short-term impact on total production. So it's a very small gain. What can we say about the speed of adjustment of prices and production? So how quickly does the economy react to the depreciation? Well, in our modeling, we show that domestic price adjustments are fully reflected in percentage depreciation within 1 year. So if you depreciate the nominal exchange rate, say by 10%, we would expect a 10% rise reversal of that within about a year. Some results are a little different sort of time lag, but that's probably a reasonably accurate reflection of the average across economic models. What happens to the aggregate economic growth? Is it higher? Growth will pick up initially for about one calendar year, but then it's lower for the next 2 to 3 years. And the reason for that is just very simply that the interest rate response to depreciation kicks in. The savings and investment rise. Well, investment accelerates initially in response to higher export growth, but moderates as growth slows down. These are our macroeconomic modeling outcomes. This would reflect the historical experience on this if you went and did econometric modeling of all the different relationships in here. These are the sorts of outcomes that you would expect to find. Macroeconomic depreciation. It should be fairly clear that I agree with Johan that what you really want to talk about here is about real depreciation, not nominal. It's the real exchange rate that actually matters here, not the nominal. And when we talk about real depreciation, what you're really talking about is lowering consumption to increase savings and investment. This lowers the trade deficit and it might lower the current account deficit as imports fall. It should increase investment. Assuming the profitability of trade goods production and import competing goods production rises. Higher investment should get you more productivity growth. And it also means less demand on non-trade goods and lower overall inflation with the productivity growth. So cumulatively, the higher investment should generate, all things added up, some kind of real exchange rate appreciation. how to lower consumption becomes an obvious question here. Well, you need to increase savings by current household debt or government. It's very difficult. Your home gets some very nice examples of how you might do that. Certainly from the Treasury's position, we've tried to do over the years to keep the fiscal deficit moving towards the surplus position until the global crisis in which we have to switch back. But the basic idea there was to try to increase savings in the economy. Just the last point here, you know, when you talk about consuming less, you're really talking about someone in the economy. So there's no free lunch. Someone has to actually pay for it. So why does inflation matter in all of this? Johan talked occasionally about adjusting the normal exchange rate for inflation. And the reason for that is going back to a variance of the equation he used. Foreign prices and domestic prices have a big role to play in the exchange rate. So this little equation here just says that your real exchange rate, the one that matters, is equal to your nominal, so that's the rand dollar amount that you think of as a paper, multiplied times foreign prices and domestic prices. So when foreign prices and domestic prices move around, it impacts on your real exchange rate. Productivity also plays a major role here. Productivity growth means the more creative, with less input, a constant price and a constant profit. You can hold profit constant when we can lower prices when productivity rises. And this is very important. So over time, productivity growth in the economy becomes the driver of economic growth, the driver of effective real appreciation. Back to our little equation here. Higher productivity growth enables lower price inflation and results in real appreciation. So to think about China and its real exchange rate, why is it so low? Consumption is low relative to income growth, but it's very high investment and savings. It has surplus labor that is mobile. It has low labor costs and high productivity. So you're taking, often labor comes out of the rural areas and goes to manufacturing jobs on the coastline, and the productivity growth implied of the economy as a whole is very high, low labor costs. Inflation target that they have is implicit and it prevents erosion of this ratio of foreign prices to domestic prices. So China recently made some changes to its monetary management. They talked a lot about how inflation had gone up and they were concerned about that. Part of what they're concerned about is to keep domestic inflation low to protect their competitiveness. And then in recent years, in the last couple of years, they actually tanked the nominal exchange rate to the US dollar. They talked quite a bit about that. The managed float. This is a slide talking a bit about what's happened over the last 10 years. We've tended to talk about this thing as a floating exchange rate, but I think it should be fairly clear that it's managed float. Inflation targeting is against floating. It doesn't require it, but it works better with the floating exchange rate. It enables greater flexibility for the central bank to sustain economic growth with less volatility. Floating allows the exchange rate to adjust to external shocks. So if there's a large inflation shock, the exchange rate can adjust to try to compensate and in effect protect the local economy and domestic economic activity. So take for example the food and oil price shock that occurred from 2006 through to 2008. If we had had a pegged or a fixed exchange rate, we would have had to have had more volatile interest rates and more volatile GDP. The fact that the exchange rate appreciated at one point in that period actually protected the economy from going through a very large swing, a very negative swing. Global financial crisis. This is just a rough breakdown. 70% was just kind of exposed this point about what the exchange rate does when it floats. It basically protects about 70% of the economy and makes it less volatile. but at the expense of the more volatility coming through the exchange rate. So when exporters and importers complain about volatility of exchange rate, there's a particular reason for it. The escape and explanation clause that was provided in the inflation targeting framework increases the flexibility further to address external and or supply shocks of inflation, again without major changes to interest rates. It's hard to think about what the exchange rate does in the absence of thinking a little bit about what the inflation targeting framework does. Ford book was closed. Johan spoke quite a bit about this, so I won't go through it. Essentially, to reverse the negative net foreign exchange position as a build reserve. This has a wrong numbers. But the purchase of reserves certainly leaned against depreciating rand. So over this period, from essentially 2003 to 2004 on, the foreign exchange reserve purchases prevented, at least at some level, to some degree, further exchange rate appreciation. Here's some of the numbers just to sort of talk, just to show you the relationship I'm trying to talk about between the moving exchange rate and the more stable domestic economy. I've just broken down a couple of variables here between the 1980s, 1990s, and the 2000s. The first column on the left shows rand volatility, and you can see that in the most recent decade, rand volatility was as high as it was in the 1980s. So it is true, certainly, that the rand has become more volatile. The third column there shows interest rate volatility, and what you see here is a very sharp decline in interest rate volatility over the period. We went from 0.63 down to 0.34, so it's essentially cutting the volatility of interest rates in half. GDP, we don't want to draw too close a causality between the less interest rate volatility and GDP, but certainly it has some effect, and you can see GDP rising to 3.2 average from the 2000s, opposed to 1.4 and 1.5 in the previous decade, and employment, again, is considerably stronger. There are some risks of depreciation. I won't go through those. I think they're fairly well known. I talked about them a bit earlier. So, how do we achieve risks of data? This is my last slide. On the macroeconomic side, we obviously want to increase savings and investment. We want to do this in part through a more countercyclical fiscal policy, something that we've been endeavoring to do for a number of years now. We are certainly interested in seeing more active foreign exchange accumulation. You've seen the pace of that build up over the last 8-9 years, and we would like to see that continuing. We also want to get more consistent achievement of lower inflation. That's critical for achieving the real effective exchange rate appreciation that we want for better manufacturing production. One of the things we might do more of is more active communication on the exchange rate. I think you've seen a little bit more of that by the governor and the minister. On the microeconomic side, clearly one of the key things would be to incentivize productivity growth with industrial policy. Part of that is about lowering the cost and raising the productivity of all sorts of inputs to the economy. Essentially, you want to make these things more efficient. Strengthening competition with competition policy would be a useful contributor to this. And we might think a bit about how to increase competition and other private investment into networks infrastructure industries and other sectors.
given the complexity of all those areas and the fact that you have to take everything into account, government nevertheless has to take decisions and choices at a particular time. And the secret, it seems to me, of the Asian tiger is that they're not afraid of taking decisions. Therein, catching one variable which is going to have a certain consequence, even if its impact on other variables is negative. So it seems to me that, you know, as a parliamentary committee which tries to assist the policy making, the choices are facing us in the IPAC, which is what we're talking about now. And therefore, while it's not enough to say that you need to balance A against B, there may be a time when you favor A rather than B, and then reverse B and A. Because that's the way, for example, that tariffs work, etc., how you manage your current account. Would you agree that certainly we in Parliament have to take some view on how to shift the balance at a particular time, especially in the light of IPAC? That's my first question. The second question is this. We understand that the country is actually plagued by a consumer debt burden. There's an awful lot of consumption going on which is financed by credit, a lot of it irresponsible, and this has created a kind of financial bubble, and which has distorted the investment in the economy. Is that true, and what do we do about it? Thirdly, the question of savings. What do you say about the PIC, the GPS, and the huge amount of savings in pensions, which of course have to be safeguarded, but nevertheless could be used proactively, as has been done in Brazil, for example, and other countries? Are we not being too cautious in the way that we talk about that? And the last point, Chair, is the question of the services sector. There are people, and in the presentations, I think, by Dr. Kaniyeva, or maybe yourself, I forget which, a reference was made to the importance of the service sector. I think you did something about the balance between manufacturing and productive areas of the economy and the service sector. Are we moving in the right direction in South Africa? Is the balance right? Should we change things? Because this is decision-making time, and we need to take decisions. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm all aware.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to go back to that one graph that you've shown us, the exchange rate movement in manufacturing and production. I just want to know from you, I don't know whether my assumptions are correct, but in that 2003, it seems like your confidence in manufacturing was relatively high, irrespective of the movement in the exchange rate, because it stayed relatively volatile, or relatively consistent. Whereas in 2007-2008, manufacturing fell, you know, the same way as the exchange rate fell, and one would actually expect the, you know, the opposite to happen in that time. Is that what was the reason for that? Is that a matter of confidence in the manufacturing industry? I know that the effect of the world economy, the global economic crisis, has probably added to that. Because, I mean, we're actually losing out enormously in terms of manufacturing capacity and obviously competitiveness as well. How do you respond to that? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm Bob Maria. I'm Bob Barker.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. My first point is to make a request to the Chief of the to say that the note that we receive are highly appreciated. And because of that, the department is fairly better short than us, the commission. I would request that when clubs are concerned, they try to produce them in color, you know, and make a precise number. So then anything additional to your art, then they can. So that's the first request. And then my other point. Is it not possible medium term and the long term, bring both people on board. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm going to
Thank you, sir. That's an echo for one of the Mama Sotos that both to the President and also to the leader. The gentleman is speaking to love the economy. The last time I was exposed to the economy was 80, 89 feet. So I was it's very helpful to particularly with the acronym and that, but it's nothing to present, but it's not a thing for us to consume and it would have been different to the name. Chairman, my question is, I'd like to concentrate much more on what relates to people itself in particular. The first question is the logic question that I was do you think that the current financing of the party that it is, given that obviously the indications are that this is an initiative that it has to turn around our economic structure of production in the country? And secondly, part of one of the key components of IPAC food is leveraging public procurement. If you have a good for the service, also, just give a comment from its angle as National Treasury on that. The last area, the last slide there, quite exciting, but I thought one of the things that the government has helped us is to share with us how the labor pool synchronization of the two policies. I'll tell you why. What is the name? The name is that it's difficult to remember. Apologies for that. A couple of students that in the area of the public hearing, last month, have emphasized the need for synchronization of the two policies, the macroeconomic policy and microeconomic policy. And then, obviously, from our side, it would be of interest to see how that, what to see from federal, national federal, on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I
have
answered it, and I look on my National Treasury then, to fund. This is respect for the handouts, etc. I'm sure you will be sending, I hope, the electronic version to our secretary to print for you. The point is made there to bring these up a little to colour. Informed as you can be about that's not what
is there a credit bubble? No, we don't think there was a credit bubble. There was a period in the 2000s where South Africa was in quite a good place. Interest rates could come down, inflation had come down, and so there was quite strong growth in credit and in the economy. The Treasury and the Minister of Finance at the time, and the other finance certainly, warned quite a lot about the growth in credit at the time, and suggested that this was not something that would have suggested that this was something that was of concern to the authorities. Certainly, if you look back at our budget statement, we talked quite a lot about the growth in household debt as a percentage of disposable income, and so that growth rate was a concern. Was it a bubble? I think that's really hard to say. Did it grow too fast? Relative to income, probably. The National Credit Act, I think, we supported and was obviously a step in the right direction to do something about the growth rate of credit, as were the monetary policy responses at the time. From the Treasury's perspective, that was also the period when we moved more strongly towards reducing the fiscal deficit, which also weighed against the credit growth. I wouldn't call it a bubble, but it was certainly a concern. In terms of financing and saving the GTF, that savings is in the economy. So that's all intermediated through the institutional savings financial structure. I think the question really for you is whether or not that savings can be used in a better way, more efficiently, with a higher rate of return. I think that's the critical economic question to ask. I don't have an answer to that. I think the IPAP is certainly a step in the right direction towards trying to answer that question, but it's really a set of microeconomic questions. Are there industries out there where more capital can be employed in a useful way at a higher rate of return with more investment, more productivity, and more investment? On the citizen sector growth issue, I think it's useful to take a step back here. I think what we've seen over the last 20 years, and again, this graph, which I've got up there, shows this, I think, quite well, that black line is positive almost the whole time. Now, what that means is the manufacturing production is growing. Is it growing as fast as services? No. And that's why in one of the Hans slides, he shows the manufacturing percentage of GDP going down. So while manufacturing has been growing, and obviously some sectors have been growing faster than others, there's some that have declined, and others that have grown quite robustly. Overall, the overall manufacturing sector has continued to grow reasonably well. It hasn't been as fast, and that will be a function of all the sorts of links in the chain that Johan was talking about. So your trend cost in the transport system, how efficient it is, the availability of skills, capital, the exchange rate will matter there, the cost of labor will matter there, everything that goes into it will matter. On the issue of manufacturing confidence, I haven't looked at the confidence indices, but I would be willing to bet that the latest confidence indices in the global recession are much, much lower than they were. If you were saying, I didn't quite pick it up, that confidence was higher back in 2003, that's probably right. It's hard, I think, to, in a sense, compare what's happened over the past year to anything that I've seen in my lifetime, and probably others too. This really was a severe shock to confidence across the economy, confidence in consumers, confidence in manufacturers. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. training. Yes, that's a very big issue on the last slide of the presentation. I talked a bit about efficiency and productivity and education and skills and training all feeds into that. We think that's a critically important part of the equation that leads to economic growth. Again, it's in a sense one of the most fundamental bits of the chain of economic growth. Again, to use Johann's metaphor, you've got population growth, demographic changes are sort of the what has the bedrock of the economy, and then what you do with human capital is sort of the next most important thing. People don't have skills, but their productivity will be low. And your growth rate will probably be quite low. Let me move on to the last set of questions. My apologies for going into economics, those two bit hard to follow. I think, yeah, again, to state the obvious, it's difficult to simplify all the steps that most of us like. We try, but we fail to do that most of the time. Is the current financing of IPAP adequate? I don't know. I mean, IPAP is composed or will be composed of a whole series of current and future programs, and those things would all go into the budget process and be assessed, just like any other program. So there are some parts that are ongoing that probably are moving on finance, and others that need more financing. But it's a very, an ambitious and forward-looking proposal with lots of activities assigned in it to various programs, and budgeting or something like that isn't done on block. Public procurement leveraging, this isn't really my area of treasury, but I can just say that there's an ongoing process that's quite robust and vigorous and well-attended and is actively discussing how you maximize value-added and localization, and how the regulations of the procurement system need to be aligned to deal with that. Treasury has been supportive of the overall idea. On the issue of synchronization of policies, I think they are actually quite synchronized. I mean, macroeconomic policy is focused on creating macroeconomic stability over the longer term, dealing with the impact of the financial crisis, the global recession. Currently, our deficits and our interest rate policies clearly reflect the flexibility to make the right kinds of decisions to support the economy in that respect. Treasury is simply of the view that ongoing industrial policy efforts
for us in that discussion that I've had here is not whether the GDP it seems to me, if I may add, that neither you, Dr. Sankhefa, used the word employment. The focus of our government at the moment is employment. And if the variables that you have both have dealt do not touch on increasing employment, then we are left in that kind of limbo problem. So that's our mandate. So I wonder if we could also deal with that. The GFA of money, we would hope, would be invested in a form which would increase employment and not just bring better returns.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree at all. I'm just by meaning rate of return in the broadest sense of the term. So it's employment creation if you want to be objective on that side. Okay. Let me just add to that briefly. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the point about an effectively depreciated exchange rate or competitive exchange rate and low interest rate most definitely to produce economic growth and employment creation. The two go together.
Right, we do just have a couple more, and I have also just asked Dr. Mandela to join you up here, just on the particular issue of employment. But yes, we have, I'm just taking the Honourable Mugabe and Honourable Mugabe, and a very quick point from yourself, Honourable Nicola, because you have 5 weeks.
Thank you very much for the chair. It's a follow-up on, I think my question was not answered. And I also acknowledge it may not have been answered because maybe it's a difficult question. Because it's not a question that should just be answered by Tesla. It's a question that must be answered by all of us. Treasury and the economic area are well placed to influence even other rules of affairs. Because you have that positioning of being listened to more seriously, in a certain way. I'm coming to this question of saying, I think all the time, we must always answer the question or acknowledge the challenge that faces. What should we do to ensure that those that have been left out of the mainstream economy are brought into the economy so that they become serious role players? I'm saying this because this also goes with the question. Those countries that are more or less at our level of development, how are they doing in this regard? Are they effectively having their people, generally coming in systematically so that we can have confidence that 5 years to come, 10 years to come, we think we will have changed? Because it's also possible to stay steady.
One more
for
David.
Thank
you,
Comrade
The issue why we referred to the treasury was because of the input which came from the previous presentation. One of the presentations of the most recent documentation raised the issue of the productivity of South Africa. One in particular, I can see that it also raised the issue of productivity. They spoke about the variables to affect the productivity. One was the issue of the labor cost. They compared the Thailand to our country. Yeah. They said the labor cost in Thailand is 34% lower than in South Africa. So in order for the impact to succeed, we must raise productivity. Does the treasury have any view in particular concerning our labor cost? How can we put out? How can we put out or how can we improve it? Without trampling on the labor rights in the process.
Right.
Honorable
Nicolana.
Quick question. What about the 80% on unpaid expansion? Is there a way of creative use of this fund without compromising the agenda sustainability? I don't know if you can remember, but I think it's
think what Paul is actually talking about is that in a sense, indirectly, we are expressing that there's still more funding that's necessary for hip hop to appreciate the sound.
Thank you. It says that you have done in National Treasury, one or two of the areas you would rather have put in writing, you do need to communicate this as well.
Thank you. I'm sure all the unconscious funds we can put in my fund area under my editorial policy. Thank you. On the issue of marginalized, I think is the right term, citizens, there are other countries that are better able to create jobs, more effectively use their education system to give people skills again. I think an unemployment rate of 25% or higher for the term here would be considered especially effective. That would mean what it means in the policy that work has to be done to improve those outcomes. That's why I focused on the education side of things, where people don't have the basic skills to engage in the labor force, and it's very hard to do anything about them remaining outside of the formal economy. My apologies for not answering the question quite the way you expected the first time, but I still think that's a particularly critical issue. I don't know if there are special programs that other countries have used to work on this particular issue. I mean, I think the basic question is just how fast are you able to create jobs in the economy, and over time, how do you absorb people who want to enter the labor force but who are outside of it. I think from a macroeconomic point of view, that's the critical question. So you've got a certain number of job seekers entering the labor force every year, and you need to create enough jobs to absorb those who are outside the labor force to begin with, and those that are entering the labor force. It requires a steady pace of job creation. Over the last 10 years, job creation was actually pretty strong, but then it took a dive with the global recession. And while there are jobs being created, there are more jobs being lost, so the net number is a negative number. So we actually have to reverse the positive. Rate of job destruction. It has to be very rapid. On the question of labor costs, I think our position is really a productivity issue. You need to get productivity higher, and again, it links back to the education and training issue. The automotive sector should work similarly with the relevant departments to try to see how it improves the productivity of the workforce if they're worried that they're being out-competed by Thailand. We don't take a view on the labor cost front because the productivity needs to rise. It's not, the profitability of the use of capital labor isn't a function purely of its cost. It's a function of its cost relative to its productivity.
Just to clarify,
the
question is some of the concerns that members may have at this moment. I think what we can do as well is put some of these questions back to National Treasury, more formally indicating that perhaps some of the issues, which in some cases fall outside the ambit of the Deputy Director General for ASEAN economic policy, and we do need to acknowledge that, of course, as well. But thank you very much, Lynn, for what you have been able to share. I wanted to raise a question with Dr. Miguel, though in particular, as it has been referenced, has come up on quite a few occasions, and that's the employment issue. And you gave a very comprehensive input. But perhaps you could just reflect and share that reflection with us about the employment implications
is, well, I think I would respond firstly by agreeing with Chris that growth and employment seem to complement each other, go hand in hand. It's not very separable, and the fact that, you know, there's not a lot of employment statistics and jobs in the presentation which I gave should not be taken at all, we imply a modest importance. That's actually of paramount importance. The success of the country is firstly, I think, in the end, to have sustainable jobs created on this current industry to make that horrible 24-25% unemployment go down to a respectable single digit number. But that will take time, and that is perhaps pretty much what this committee is about. And why so much economists devote their lives and attention and energy to making plans to get sustainable development. One should be mindful, though, that the way to employment creation does not necessarily go just to tradables and does not necessarily go just to manufacturing. I would caution that actually there's valuable jobs created, sustainable jobs created in the services industry that are not at all inferior, but one should also not say superior, but that are certainly also worthwhile and laudable, and that should not be taxed away or made illegal. One should really be balanced in that. The fact that America, South Africa has so much unemployment that we must look at growth across all industries, tradables, non-tradables, right from agriculture, right through to high finance and computers, all of it, that there should be jobs created right through. The Reserve Bank models, however, and our part of analysis seems to be too macro to give detailed industrial solutions. That's really not our brief or specialization. And to choose the winners and say that, you know, the sunrise industry is A, and we should all out support this and not support Z, is not, unfortunately, what we can do. Technically, that's not our focus. I think our brief is more to create a stable platform in which at least relative prices are not confused so much by inflation and by volatility that it is impossible for business people and government to figure out where the opportunities are. So we try to make price signals more consistent and to make price signals more trustworthy, trustable, by having stability-oriented and anti-inflation policies. We see our contribution in that way, and we, well, of course, we support employment creation in all its forms with the greatest humility and enthusiasm.
Thank you.
Just as a response, obviously, the service industry is very, very important. Job creation is very, very important there. But I think if one analyzes our position and what we want to do, we obviously want to decrease imports of value-added products. And we obviously want to increase, in other words, manufacturing of that in South Africa and export that to the foreign currency. The service industry is coming in South Africa, obviously you try to get tourists and other people in to supply services to them. But you can't really do that on a sustainable basis if you don't see manufacturing going up as well. We also see that the deficit in the balance of payment is purely because of, or largely because of, manufactured food that is imported. So somehow we're going to get a change there, and that must be one of the biggest mechanisms of getting employment up and running, and obviously productivity and all those kind of things. But I still have a concern in terms of the response from Treasury on that graph, and that really, I don't know whether that is an indicator to confidence in South Africa that is lower, or that is, or is there a correlation between what is happening in South Africa and foreign countries, especially if one sees what is currently happening in Brazil, and in India, and in China, and in Korea. It seems like manufacturing is increasing dramatically there, while South Africa is going the other way. isn't that a red flag to us? Isn't that that you know, us that need to really get correct that position? And somehow I think we are looking at the other macroeconomic issues that is very important, but somehow I don't see issues that you're putting forward to say that, you know, we're going to get that part correct as well. And it seems like that it's just floating behind all the other issues that we are mentioning. And if that doesn't, if we don't correct that by IFAC, IFAC is a manufacturing and industrial development. If we can't correct that, then obviously IFAC is worth nothing. And somehow we must see that in policies, in implementation plans, in obviously recommendations, as how we're going to improve that specifically with regards to IFAC. And I don't see that as a strong thing coming through. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I think we
would
welcome any comments from either of you, particularly yourself.
That graph shows real manufacturing production. So confidence has an impact on that number. But I think it would probably be more useful to sort of compare some of that manufacturing production volume relative to some of those comparisons. I mean, I think what you see is some of them picking up, some of the other countries picking up a bit more quickly than South Africa. But the most recent numbers are actually positive for South Africa. They're not continuing to fall. We've stabilized. We're going back up again. They may not be as rapid as the other ones. But you might talk a bit about this. The confidence being a sort of coincident indicator to the volume. You know, there's no doubt that confidence impact on production volume decisions, but I think that 2009 number is really about sales orders that have just collapsed, and there's a complete collapse and cutting back of everybody's actual purchases of South Africa and everyone else's manufacturing production. To the extent, I suppose, you could make an argument if you broke the numbers down that some of that production decline reflected concerns about ongoing consumption in South Africa. So it's not just exports, it's also domestic consumption of domestically manufactured products. And so, you know, in those numbers you get some impact from people, from manufacturers to say, food products, who say, well, we're going to see consumption of our food products decline, so we will stop producing as much. And that will feed through to those numbers. I don't disagree with you that manufacturing is very important, and Treasury certainly has said for a number of years that we think it's very important. From a macroeconomic point of view, we think the fiscal and monetary authorities have done what we can to support the economy as a whole. Manufacturing production, the deep jobs put on the table, the IPAC, what we think is a very useful step forward to try to deal with specifically some of the things that you're talking about. Will it build confidence? I'm sure it will send it up soon.
We really do have to adjourn at this point until 2 o'clock. But I think just to say to Dr. Lowell, that it will be quite important for us. We will be seeing some risk and communication to assist some. It may have been on our side as well, that it wasn't sufficiently explanatory with respect to National Treasury. But obviously we're concerned with the ICAP itself. So it wasn't that distinct. We were concerned with the issues around the exchange rate, labor issues, and so on. So we would like to, I think, continue that communication, and no doubt colleagues in the Treasury may also be persuaded to think through a collegiate response, as it were, to the committee. and the issues that we raise again. But I do want to thank you for being here with us this morning.